Hey everyone, you're listening to the Embrace the Messy podcast with Shannon Schinkel. I'm a high school educator, challenge seeker, lifelong learner, and embracer of all things messy. I find inspiration from individuals who are passionate about learning and embracing change. Join me as I share my experiences and interview people who will inspire you to embrace the messy too. Let's go. If you are an educator, how do you solve the I'm done my work and have nothing to do dilemma in your classrooms? When I first started teaching, like 25 plus years ago, I used to give my students free time to do what they wished. Most of the time, because I was so busy working with students who could barely meet minimum expectations for the assignment given, I would just tell students to read a book or work on learning from another class or even doodle. Later on, I became a bit more prepared, making sure I had extra assignments, which I enticed students who were done to complete for bonus marks because who doesn't want extra credit, right? These were often comprised of puzzles and word skill activities like word searches, crossword puzzles, and the like. I need fast and convenient things I could throw at kids who worked quickly and could stay out of my hair. It also stretched my ability to work with the vulnerable kids who really needed my help. But much to my chagrin, sometimes kids chose to do the extra assignments and sometimes they couldn't be bothered. And it was bonus, so they technically did not have to do it. But then if they didn't do it, some weren't self-disciplined enough to just pull out a book or help their neighbor and ultimately became disruptive or took extra long bathroom breaks, consequently getting themselves into trouble and giving me more paperwork and a headache and pulling me away from the kids who needed my help. Okay, then I tried something new. I brought in board games, card games, and puzzles for the students to do at a nearby table when they were done. I thought I was being very clever. However, I soon realized that not all students enjoyed the games, and some students rushed their work because they couldn't wait to play the games. And again, when students chose not to entertain themselves, they often took away rather than added to the classroom atmosphere, if you know what I mean. And of course, nowadays, in this age of cell phones, I often hear from teachers that students glue themselves to their phones when they're done or connect with a friend in another class to hallway wander. And, you know, sometimes they actually rush their work to do these things as well. When given the chance to do something more constructive, the students make bad choices and we need to clamp down on this behavior. That's what I hear, okay? What I've learned over my many years of swinging and missing as to how to deal with bored children in my classroom began with me starting to question my methods rather than blame the kids. Was I setting them up for success or disaster? Was it really about having the right extra things or gizmos in my class? Or was it about the learning and learning opportunities themselves? Upon reflection, I realized it was my inadequate planning that resulted in a plethora of preventable problems. Now, I get it. Sometimes kids are just naughty no matter what we do. Kids will be kids, but as with many things, and this is hard sometimes to swallow, one has to examine their own methods before they play the blame game. That kids are just disrespectful. Kids don't know how to self-regulate. Kids should know better by this age. Kids don't try hard enough. What's going on with these kids nowadays? Kids, kids, kids. And it's really, really darn easy to blame the kids. But here's the thing. Of all the factors involved, what do I have control of? I don't have control of the kids and their home lives or how they are parented. I do have control of what I do with the students. I've caught myself saying, I've tried everything. And then I've looked in the mirror and went, really, Shannon, everything? Come on, you've been giving out the same worksheet for like 8 years. Maybe it's not about the bells and whistles you try to entice them with, to try to shut them up when they're done. Maybe it's the learning itself, huh? At a granular level, my expectations for a learning opportunity often didn't meet the needs of students who needed support to be able to achieve the bare minimum, and those who are advanced and needed challenge. Now, when I transformed my practice to a standards-based and more universally designed one for students, rarely, if ever, do I have bored students. But it has taken a shift in the way I teach and assess for this to happen. Now, here's the thing. Behaviors still happen for a variety of other reasons. I don't want to suggest that my classroom is always sunshine and roses, but there aren't nearly the problems that stem from boredom or not meeting the needs of kids. In one of my previous episodes called Intentional Assessment, I talk about how the construction of proficiency scales and teaching to each level is paramount. Today, I want to dig in a little bit into how each level on a proficiency scale or rubric keeps students moving forward. I want you to think of a goal you currently have for your students. And I want you to focus on the action or skill you want them to achieve. So avoid saying things like, I want my students to complete a lab, or I want my students to write a paragraph. Okay. You might say you want students to be able to, I want them to be able to generate a hypothesis and be able to report on findings. Or I want them to be able to compose a multi-sentence paragraph with a topic sentence, coherent body sentences, and profound conclusion, and accurately cite evidence. Okay, so that's more of a skill-based goal. To envision the four-point proficiency scale for a goal like that, you want to envision a pathway, and each level becomes cognitively more enriching. Now, you aren't creating steps to do the skills here. Like, you're not breaking down its components. You are actually considering the result from its simplest or most crucial form, right? That's kind of like thinking about the bare minimum for that grade level to its progressively most advanced iteration, okay? So instead of just thinking about somewhere in the middle, you are actually thinking about all possible levels. When you present the learning opportunity as a chance to work on a skill and show students what each level looks like and each's expectations, we can gamify the learning experience. I mean, think about it. In a video game, players enter at level one and zoom from level to level at their own pace. The game coaches them as to what they have to do to get to the next level. When a player leaves the game, the next time they play, they pick up from the level they left off. If they aren't successful at a certain level, the game shuffles them down until they're ready. But there's always another chance to get back up to the level they wanted to get to in the first place. And the game is prepared for whatever the player knows and can do. There is no scrambling or retrofitting on the fly. You know, the game is prepared. You know, they don't get to level six and, oh, you're ready for seven? I'm not ready. I guess I have to make something up here really quick, right? It's already prepared. And I think we can learn a lot from video games in our classrooms. Teaching to a range of learners is nothing new. If we present a learning opportunity that aims for the average student, we aren't going to address the students who need supports to get there or challenges to advance themselves past average. This isn't a streaming problem. This is an us problem. By presenting the expectations for each level of proficiency, students can set goals for themselves. They can self-assess where they're at because they can compare their learning to the expectations for the level or exemplar. When they see where they're at now, there's always a challenge, the next level up. And if we provide all the resources students might need to backtrack or relearn or support them at any point, We won't be retrofitting on the fly to meet students' needs, and every student will always have a new challenge. And this is why then they're not as bored. In my classroom, this process is still perfectly imperfect. But what impresses me the most is how, by gamifying the process, it's actually empowered my students because they are responsible for accessing the support they require throughout the learning process, and they're improving their metacognitive abilities since they're always reflecting on their learning. Now, to address the question you're all thinking, is this more work? Yes. Yes, it's more work. Okay. I have to prep a lot more in advance. That's the truth. But when I consider all the time I wasted writing discipline referrals and having to retrofit on the fly, you know, my classroom was mayhem before. It gave me a headache and I complained all the time. And the worst part is kids weren't successful. The kids who needed challenge were only ever given the opportunity to do average work. The kids who needed supports barely had my attention. It just wasn't working. It just wasn't a good system. Well, so now it's game time for educators to choose between sticking with the old system or leveling up to one that truly meets every kid where they are.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. You can find out more at teachbetter.com/podcasts. Now let's get back to the episode.
Tyler Rablin is an instructional technology coach and former high school language arts teacher for Sunnyside School District in Sunnyside, Washington. His passion for education centers on how intentional technology integration, modernized assessment practices, and strong cultures of learning can provide meaningful, powerful, and personal learning experiences for each student. Tyler reached out to me a while back, before we had this amazing interview, to check out his new book called Hacking Student Motivation, 5 Assessment Strategies That Boost Learning Progression and Build Student Confidence. You know, the Hack Learning series is amazing, and this book, I had absolutely no problem giving it a 5-star review. I couldn't put it down. I started reading it, thinking I was going to be able to do it over a few days. I couldn't put it down. I reached out to him. I said, I cannot wait to chat with you on the podcast. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Tyler Rablin. Hello, Tyler Rablin. Welcome to the Embrace the Messy podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me here. I'm excited.
I am so excited. I'm so excited to talk about your new book. It's going to be a great conversation. Before we get started, I just want to express my appreciation. I was one of the super lucky ones to get an advanced book, look at your book, Hacking Student Motivation. And I just loved every page of it. And I, you know, you and I, we just met like 5 minutes ago, but we know each other from the Twitter sphere, from the social media sphere, and you and I both have this assessment love language. We've totally embraced it. But I just want to thank you again for including me in your 2.5-year journey to write this book. It was awesome.
Oh, I so appreciate it. I have so much respect for you and your thoughts around assessment. So I was pumped when you were willing to be one of the early readers. So thank you.
Well, and you and I go back and forth. I love that on social media. Like I can't stand calling it X, but I know it's X, but right. you know,
can't
Twitter.
say it either.
And it was like, you know, you making your progressions. And I was like in the midst of doing like the proficiency sequences and was like, oh my gosh, someone who is like working very similarly on things that I'm trying to work on. So anyway, I just feel like you're my assessment soul brother. And I can't wait to dig in. Can't wait, can't wait, can't wait. But before we get into this beautiful book, I'm fascinated by origin stories, and I'd just love to know, you know, what's your story? How did you get into teaching, and what's your role now in education?
Yeah, so I didn't really know I wanted to be a teacher for I know there's a lot of really cool stories where people just knew their whole life, like, I want to be a teacher, that's what I'm going to do. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I actually was better at math, which is funny because now I teach English, but I had my senior year of high school, actually the year before junior year, I was always a kid freshman sophomore year that like we had a book to read and I found the way around it and would write the paper and hope, like that was me. And then junior year, I picked up a copy of, oh, is it The Red Pony? I think it's called The Red Pony, Steinbeck. I don't even actually like the book. I've tried to reread it. I thought it, but for some reason as a junior, I fell in love with that book. And I just started reading, like I could not stop reading. As a young kid, I loved reading. I got into sports and I felt like it just fell away. And then junior year, I fell in love with reading again. And senior year, I had an English teacher who was just awesome. He really pushed me that, you know, English class isn't about necessarily the books and the formats for essays. It's about learning to find what you value and communicate that. And so he really kind of was the first time I thought maybe I do want to be a teacher because he really helped me see something different about the world, about myself. And I thought that would be the coolest thing to be able to do that with my life moving forward. So throughout college, I played music. That was what I did. I loved music. That was my way of writing. I was getting towards the end of college, like junior year, and I was like, I got to figure out what to do with my life. And so decided to go into teaching. Went down to Portland, did my master's program down there. At that time, this was 2013 is when I was going into the teaching field. And I just remember standing in job fair lines where there were like two positions open and like 100 teachers. Very different landscape than it is right now in the US. And so I was like, you know what? I really want to teach. I'm not tied down anywhere. I'm going to go. And so I picked up and moved to rural Eastern Oregon out in Milton Freewater. And part of what I loved about kind of getting out there, I was the only junior English teacher. And I had a principal who was really good about just saying, what do you need? What do you need to try? What are you going to explore? And so my first 3 years I taught in that school, and I was given so much sort of creative rein about what I wanted to do with teaching, what I wanted to do with assessment. I remember sort of in this journey that within the first 2 years, actually it was my second year at the end, I had a student who was failing my class miserably. And the part that I could not figure out is she was probably one of the most brilliant writers I've ever had in my class. She was one of the most voracious readers I've ever had in my class. And that was the moment where I realized something was broken about how I was assessing. I was doing what I've always done. So I sat down with my principal, Ralph. He gets a shout out in the book because he really meant a lot to me, and really helped shape who I am as an educator. He really just said, what matters most is the student, right? Like there's all these rules and the things that we think we have to do in education, but he was like, does she know what she needs to know? And he said, he was like, there are definitely things she needs to work on, right? She didn't want to do the writing for class, didn't want to do the reading for class, but she knew what she needed to know. And so he was like, let's give her a pass. And so she got a pass. And that was the first time that I was like, basically, we did that. And then I sat down, school was out, and I was like, before I start teaching again next year, I gotta figure something else out because it's not working. So that started my journey with assessment and grading practices and feedback and motivation and all that. And then I moved up to Central Washington State. So the Sunnyside School District is where I'm at now. I taught English there for a little while again, and then shifted into a coaching role. I did it for 4 years. I did it part-time, was in the classroom. I did that through COVID, and I was officially an instructional technology coach. And that those years of online and hybrid stuff, like, I was so happy I could support teachers, but by the end of that, I just needed to get back in the classroom. So I went back to the classroom full time for a couple years, teaching my freshmen. I love ninth grade students. Like, I never thought that would come out of my mouth, but I loved, they're just
ninth
fun.
Grade is hard.
It is
hard.
If I had hair, I would pull more of my hair out, but like,
yeah,
they're just fun and I enjoyed it. And so I did that for a couple of years. And then this year is the first year I've actually been fully out of the classroom. It's been a really weird transition for me. I don't know how long it will last for me. I miss it. There's definite value, and I'm appreciative of being able to support other teachers a little more directly in this role, but I'm missing teaching some of these days right now. So,
you know what I love about that story is the fact that it's the people that have impacts on our life, have the impact on our lives. Like, it can be just for a short term, but has such a long-term impact. You had your English teacher that made you, mm-hmm. Decide to go into teaching. And I also love that, when I talk to different teachers in the States, like, depending on where you're at, I hear such a different story about creative rain, right? And there's this feeling that they're so tied to certain expectations, especially when it comes to assessment. There has to be so many things in your grade book. You have to turn that grade book in every week. And I just blink, like, my jaw drops. And it's so beautiful that you had this person that said, hey, what do you need? Mm-hmm. It's such a simple thing. Like, that's like, I think the greatest piece of advice we can give to any administrator is to look at a teacher and go, what do you need? Instead of, it feeling like a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. And the story with the gal who, the assessment didn't reflect the score, right? And we only know what we know, right? Mm-hmm. I've been doing this, so I graduated from my program a little bit further back than you. It was like 1997. So my first year of teaching was 1998. And you just did what you were taught to do, right? Mm-hmm. And I had amazing coaching teachers, right? I had amazing teachers I worked with in my first jobs. And like you said, it was hard even back then to get a job. You did what you could to try to land a job. And then the evolution happens, right? It's that realization that the system is broken. How can we get assessment to actually reflect what students know and can do? So let's get into that. Okay, so we're going to dive into your book. So in chapter one, you have design an informative grade book. Oh, and this is my favorite metaphor in the whole book, okay? You challenge teachers to change up their existing grade books, which are often task-based rather than skill-based, because you say that traditional grade books become a vending machine for grades. Oh, I love that metaphor. I'm like, oh my God, a vending machine. Now, can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. I mean, it's at its core, it's a transactional approach to learning in the classroom, right? It's this idea that students give us something, a project, a test, and we return that with a grade, right? And it's that, like, it's the equivalent. If I were to put a dollar bill in a vending machine, out comes the thing that I'm looking for, And so that's how I was viewing it, is kids just were giving me things and I was giving them other things. And I was like, at what point is learning involved? Because I just didn't feel like learning was really a part of that. It was just like, we were changing money. That's all we were doing.
Yeah.
And so that was, And that, that really, that student that I told the story about, she was the one that really made me question this transactional approach to grading and assessment. As I was like, okay, well, basically, like, she gave me all this other evidence. She just didn't give me that one piece of evidence I was looking for. And so I was just like, all right, I got to change it. Right. And really, when it becomes that vending machine, that's where you get students that start obsessing about points and about, and those are like my least favorite conversations. Even the simple question, and I get why they ask it, is this graded? They're literally asking like, all right, is this going to be part of that vending machine? Can I put this in and get the thing out? And so that's where I was like, all right, something's got to shift. Our priorities are not aligned with learning in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I like the fact that, you know, shifting from task-based to skill-based, it becomes more about your professional judgment. And you know, I've written about this,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes more of this amazing new system where instead of the transactions, you can look at a plethora of evidence, take a step back and go, here's where you're at. This is what I know you can do. And even better yet, here's the skill we're working on. How do you want to show your learning? Right?
Yeah.
And that's the engagement piece, right? Mm-hmm. That's like Heather Lyon's work, right? Well, engagement is not a unicorn. That's the engagement piece. So the grade book needs to flip, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
It also reminds me of, okay, so here's a little story. So at the end, so me switching to standards-based grading, right, is at the end of the year, I'll give my kids a marks update, but it'll be where you're at on the proficiency scale for each of the standards, or my power standards, right, the clusters. And then they can decide where, if they want to level up just in those last few days. I kind of give them a few days, literally like off. And then kids have the opportunity to try to level up, which I think works so beautifully. But like you talk about the vending machine, at the end of the year, if kids are missing assignments, I think it's hilarious that, and I say hilarious sarcastically, that a kid can literally take a pile of assignments that's overdue and just the physical action of handing it to the teacher, the grade's going up.
Yep.
Am I wrong?
It's spot on.
Right?
Yeah.
Because it's the points, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it might not be by, you know, like much. It'll be just enough to pass. But when we actually go to skills-based, kids actually have to prove they can do skills at a certain level. Like, it's cognitive rigor. Like, they have to prove it, right? Because I get, and I'm sure you do too, and we can talk about that. Like, it's the pushback sometimes, right?
Yeah.
What are you doing? You know, how do you get kids to do stuff that doesn't all count, right? Well, they have to show me they can do it. I'm not, just because they put in a day's labor doesn't mean I'm automatically bumping up their mark. Would you agree on that? With that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you said like the sort of the cognitive rigor. I think a lot of times there's this misconception that when we switch to standards-based practices, standards-based grading, somehow something gets easier, right? Or it's just about grade inflation. But I mean, I've found it to be oftentimes the opposite, where there's not just free random points that kids can get for handing a paper to a teacher. Now it's
right. Completion marks.
Yeah. Like just these points that are like for nothing, right? They don't demonstrate learning or anything. And I mean, I found out, especially when I started sitting down with students and looking at a learning progression and saying, where is your evidence that shows us where you're at in this learning progression? That process was much more rigorous than the way that I was grading students before, because there was so much reflection, so much metacognition, so much really looking at what did I show, not just what did I turn in, what did I actually demonstrate that I know here? Can I prove it? Can I prove that I know this?
Mm-hmm. Is conversation a big part of this process for you? Like, is
yes.
it, do you have these intentional discussions with your kids, like at a, like a term end before you do a report card?
Yeah. So I actually switched, and this took a long time of me rearranging how I structured my instructional approaches and my curriculum planning. But my goal was to sit down with every student every 2 weeks to be able to look at, we would do sort of mid-unit check-ins where we would sit down and say, what evidence do we have so far? Let's set some goals for the rest of the unit. We'd do unit end check-ins where it would be, all right, we're to the end. Let's talk about this learning progression. What have you shown? Where are we at? And then I would do like an end of trimester check-in. And that's where really where we'd sit down and say, you know, these are the big standards that we are covering. This is the evidence that we've talked about, the score you're at now. And I love, you talked about sort of your like your final assessment where it's like, hey, this is what we covered. Let's level some of these up. That to me, that was one of my favorite reasons for shifting is I was able to like, instead of just, hey, here's this big test that is everything we've talked about for the entire term. It's like, no, no, no. You're doing great in these skills. There's two skills that you're struggling with. I can give you your final. I'm going to give you some time to work on those.
Oh my gosh.
And it just,
that's love language to me, buddy. Like that's huge because that's, I think the biggest, I'm not anti-test. Like I'm not, I think I have changed how I structure the test as evidence of learning. And I'm cognizant of the fact that it is just another way to show learning. And if a student, say, without going too much into detail, shows it in another way and they don't do well in the test, I have to be aware that it could be the fact that Mike felt too high pressure. Okay, so there's that, right? But it's this opportunity to give them time in class to apply that feedback. And even like for me, some of the kids, they were just fine, right? They looked at their scores. They had had their goal at the beginning of the year. They have the time now. And I might only get in a class of 28 kids, I might only get three who'd actually decide to level up. But, you know, with that time, they all do it. They all make it. They get that extra one-on-one coaching, you know, they get all of that. But it's the problem I find with a final exam, and I'm sure I've heard you, you know, talk about this or write about this even in the Twitter sphere, is that it becomes such a high pressure situation that kids, you know, cram as much information as they can. Right. And there's and so the product doesn't end up being very good. And here it winds up being 20 or 30% of their grade in 2 hours. Right. And there's a lot of, there's research out there that talks about how, you know, this idea of getting kids to like creatively think, it doesn't happen as well. If we want kids to show that creative thinking, especially as English teachers, you know, if we're getting them to, you know, take a prompt and like write a little story or a poem or even do like a personal narrative or something like that, you know, they're not going to put out the quality piece.
Yeah. And the other piece too, then that builds off that is if, you know, let's say there's that big final test that's 30% of their grade. When I was a lot of what I did looking into motivation, one of the worst things we can do for motivation is if someone struggles or doesn't do well, and then that's final, right? Like if I don't know it and I never get a chance to do it and I move on, the message that I hear over and over is, you can't do it, right? We're not going to give you time because we would never say this out loud to a student. But a lot of what I talk about is sort of the hidden communication that happens around grading and assessment. When a student fails or doesn't learn something and we move on, there's a hidden message in there of either it's not important for you to learn this, or I don't think you can learn it, so let's just move on. And for a lot of students, especially our students who are our most struggling students, their academic confidence, their self-efficacy is already super low. And that's just reinforcing that story they already have in their head. I can't do it. Look, here's more evidence that supports that story I've written about myself. And so that's the other reason why I really wanted to shift that final assessment to, hey, this is not about like a last final thing where it's done. This is, we've done work all term. There might be some things you're still struggling with. I believe that you can do this. I want to give you another shot at it before we wrap things up. There's a reality that like just calendar structure wise, things end. And there might be a student that doesn't fully get it by that arbitrary ending point that we have to have in our schools. But my goal in my classroom is how can I, as long as I can, continue to give students opportunities if they're struggling to grow and see that success and then build their confidence and self-efficacy that way.
Oh, I'm chiming little bells there for you, Tyler. Well, and here's the thing that I appreciate in what you also said. Like you had to restructure your semester. So teachers out there who are considering a shift to standards-based grading and learning progressions, which we're going to get into what exactly those are. It involves a restructuring of like the semester, because what I'm hearing you saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, you actually cycle through your standards over and over again. So kids have multiple attempts of learning something. And basically the idea that learning doesn't end until the semester ends. Is that a fair assessment? Because I think what I'm noticing in my area, and I know that this is a baby step, and I want to acknowledge right now on the air here that I know it's a baby step for some educators, that they're aware of the standards. So they're trying to touch on all the standards. But what might end up happening is they're touching on the standard, and after the 3-week unit is over, they never look at that standard again. So if a kid misses that unit for whatever reason, it's gone by. Or guess what? Now, in terms of what we're now doing that's new in unit two, you got to make up also what was in unit one.
Yeah. And now
And
you're
it
buried
becomes
in
a,
more.
and what's the quality going to be like, Tyler?
Yeah, we know how that one goes. Yeah.
Yeah. So it does involve a restructuring. Like, how can it be an evolution over at least not even necessarily the whole semester, but at least as much of the semester as we can? Is that fair?
Yeah, and part of it, so there is like intentionally building into our curriculum some spiraling. And I know I feel like as an ELA teacher, we have somewhat of an advantage because we
We
are going
do.
to write multiple times. And so it's easy to
Yes.
spiral different concepts and standards in there. But the other piece that I found, because I think sometimes when we talk about that spiraling piece or revisiting standards multiple times, it feels overwhelming at first. And so one step that I found that was really helpful is, let's say there were four standards we covered in the previous unit. Moving into the next unit, I might do like 10, 15, 20 minutes at the beginning of a class period where our entry task is, hey, these are the four standards we covered last unit. I want you to choose the one that you're struggling the most with, and maybe there's a resource linked. So I'm not restructuring my whole curriculum that way because I know that there's too much on teachers' plates as it is right now. But instead of having to restructure everything, I'm just adding in, it's not like woven into the curriculum, but it's there. It's another opportunity for the student to practice it too. Because even the student that gets it, I mean, we know how our brains work. They're super efficient. If we have information and then we stop using it, our brain's like, well, got to free up some space, and out that information goes. And so it's just revisiting it for our brain's sake. Even if we learned it previously, it helps us make sure that that's going to stay in that long-term memory.
Okay, so that was great. And let's look at learning progressions. Okay. So in your book, you get into a chapter, you define what a learning progression is. And some of our listeners might be going, learning progression? Like, I know. Okay. So where I'm coming from, where I'm at, we look at a learning progression, we use the language a little bit differently. So I just want to get listeners, especially, if you're like in Canada, often the idea of a learning progression, kind of starts at like the lower end of Bloom's taxonomy and moves up to whatever the higher order thinking is. Okay. So like that's a little different. That's more like a learning ladder. Okay. You view a learning progression very much to any of the li my listeners who have looked at some of my work with proficiency sequences, right? And it's closer to aligned with the idea of a proficiency scale. Okay. So I just wanted to put that out there just so, again, I know it's like depending on where you're at, how everybody uses kind of different language. But what I love about this chapter is you take a moment, and if you could summarize, what's the difference between what you consider a learning progression and a rubric?
Yeah, for me, they're two tools that perform best at different ends of the process of learning. So a rubric for me is designed to evaluate how we do on a task where we're trying to demonstrate what we've already learned. You think about your typical rubric, there's maybe four or five parts on it, different stages, and you've got a couple at the top that mean you did it and you did really well, some at the bottom that say you're not there yet. That's really what it is.
And
And
often
they are,
that deficit-based language too, right?
yes,
Yes,
yeah.
right.
I sometimes joke that like I'm great at this or I suck at this, and we put it in different
Yeah.
boxes, but that's really
Yeah.
how it comes across.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't want to, rubrics are important. They have some very, you know, they've done studies on one of the ways that we can decrease implicit bias in our grading practices. One of the only things they found is a well-constructed rubric that is calibrated between teachers to ensure that the impact of our implicit bias is minimized. So I sometimes when I talk about rubrics, I get a little flippant about it, and it sounds like they're bad. You don't you they have value, but for me, learning progressions are something that is helpful at the beginning of learning any sort of concept or approaching any sort of standard. Because what it is, it's I use the analogy that it's a map. Like if I hike, I love hiking, being outside. Like if I'm standing at a trailhead and someone just gives me a rubric that's like either you're at the top of the mountain or you aren't, because that's really what a rubric would say. That's not helpful for me at that point. I'm like,
Bye, I suck.
yeah. I'm like, I don't, I'm just gonna stand in the trailhead parking lot and wait for someone to pick me up because I don't know where to go. And I think kids feel like this sometimes when, you know, when we see students who don't even attempt to start learning something, it's because they're having that experience that I was joking about there of I don't even know where to go or where to start. And so a learning progression takes that standard we're expecting them to do and it unpacks it backwards, going all the way back to if I'm brand new to this idea, what's my first place that I could have a quick win? Maybe that's just learning a couple definitions that I need to be able to have that language to engage in the conversation. But what it does is it allows the reason I started using learning progressions more than I use rubrics in my classroom, when I'm especially with students, is it means that every student in my classroom can find a spot where their learning is valued, right? Whereas before, if I'm on the lower end of a rubric, I got a long ways to go before I feel like I'm successful at any piece of this. And so even if it's just a couple words that they need to know, maybe it's background knowledge that we assume they learned in previous grades, something that a student can say, I can do this. Like I got this. This is my first step and really helps. The biggest thing for me is if I can give students evidence early on of success, it convinces them that more success is coming. And that's where that learning progression is so valuable in the classroom.
Oh, so I just this it touches on so much because I in a previous episode, I did my first solo episode, that one on intentional assessment. And you like, I love this idea of every level becomes a goal, and it's almost like kids are, crossing that finish line at every level, like running through the ribbon, woohoo, I made it, right? And then the next one is the next level, woohoo, they made it, right? When it's a deficit-based rubric, if the deficit-based rubric, if emerging says, has flaws, is incoherent and disorganized, not exactly a goal, right?
Nope, not what I'm aiming for.
Not exactly a goal. It's a judgment. And when we do that with kids, they feel valued. They feel valued. And like I quote, like we have a psychologist, child psychologist in Alberta, who's Dr. Jody Carrington, and kids have never felt more disconnected, like prior to COVID and now after COVID. And I think this is one also one little way, besides, having obviously interpersonal conversations with them, that we can tell them you are valued because I have set up these goals for you that are achievable for you, and I'm going to do everything I can to get you to the next level.
And I love that you talked about it like running a race or crossing that finish line because you know, there's a, it's called the goal gradient theory, but it's this idea that the closer we are to a goal, the more we feel motivated to accomplish that goal. It's, you know, if you're running a race, midway through the race, you're ready to throw in the towel and, you know, go grab your favorite snack or whatever. But as soon as you can see the finish line, all of a sudden you might have been dead, but you're sprinting. Like you know, that motivation shows up. And I think for a lot of our students, if they feel that they're a long, long way from success, if we define it as just being proficient in the standard, that motivation, it's not going to be as strong as if with a learning progression, we can say, hey, this is your goal. It's right here. Look at how close you are to this goal. That's a very different experience for that student.
It's one of the other problems. Like, I think there's a place for like a single point rubric, but I think that's actually you touch on. I think that's the biggest problem with a single point is if we put what's proficient or the highest level down the center, it's so far away, right? By
yeah.
unpacking it into all these little goals, it's important. Okay, so you create your grade level progression for a standard. Okay, but Tyler, what if you've got that set up and you walk into your classroom and you've got a handful of learners who are not yet ready for what you call, I think beginning is your first level, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if they're not ready for that? What do you do?
I like the language piece you brought up. I used to put beginning, developing. I've now changed it to just, I put phase one, phase two, phase three.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just, you know, yes, it is beginning, but I think there's still an element of deficit there. And I know it's playing with language a little bit.
I
but...
know. And then, you know, Tom, I'll have the conversation with Tom too. Right. And I know Tom Schimmer will say, don't get hung up on the levels. Well, guess what? Teachers still kind of get sometimes hung up on the levels. So I think, yeah, no, anyway, continue what you're saying.
Yeah. Throw
it.
Me
I
in a classroom
it.
With 30 kids. And I'm probably the only one who's actually concerned about it, to be realistic,
right.
But
yeah.
you know, I'm still going to be concerned about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the big thing for me is even if a student comes in with significant gaps in their knowledge from previous years, and you know, if I haven't designed that first level of the learning progression to be accessible to anybody, no matter where they're at, I made a mistake. And I will say my learning progressions get revised all the time. Whether it's just, you know, I'm getting a different batch of students and they're going to be in different places and I'll need to approach it slightly differently. But really what I've found to work is if that first level is key vocabulary, most students, it's accessible for them. They might not have it already, but it's a quick win for them. Or it's something where, you know, if I've got 20 minutes after class before, you know, before everybody leaves for the day, I've got 20 minutes and I can sit down with a student. My goal is that level one should be something that in 20, 30, 40 minutes, I can help that student understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. I like that because is you're anticipating the dynamic of a class.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And now we have, I'm going to say, the luxury of experience behind us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where when we see there's like a trend, right? So that we can then actually design these progressions, anticipating that we're going to have these kids who are struggling. And I know like what you're saying, it reminds me of Shelley Moore's work. She's an inclusive educator. You might've seen her on Twitter, just absolutely fabulous. And it's called Designing Windows. So if we have like little extra entry points. So if I have my, like we have a 4-point proficiency scale in BC. And if we have that emerging, developing, proficient and extending, we've designed that for grade level, but when we walk in and we find out that we need to add in other entry points that come before emerging, right? So it's essentially kind of what you're doing there because you've got the five, you've got that extra time. And depending on where the students are at, we just make those windows as the goal, right? Those little entry points. So like, how can we give them an accessible goal? So again, they feel seen, right?
Mm-hmm.
They feel like this is achievable and it's not so far away, right? And
yeah.
I know when we talk about learning gaps or learning loss, some people might go, that's not real. And I'm like, oh, it is like totally real. Like, whoa, like a kid takes something and a course and it ends in January. And if they don't get it back again until February of the next year, there's going to be a gap. So we have to anticipate those, right?
Yeah. And another thing that I found to be really helpful, I have the benefit. So I taught freshmen and sometimes that disconnect, if you know, eighth grade is your middle school, you don't get to see those teachers. We got a few opportunities over the year to be able to actually meet with our eighth grade team in sort of a transitions meeting, and meeting with the teachers, the grade level, two grade levels below, and asking, hey, what are the key things that students coming out of your grade need to know about this skill? Or even what are the things students struggle with the most around this skill? And being able to have that conversation really helped me actually make sure those first few levels in a learning progression matched what I most likely was going to see from students coming in, because those teachers knew, right? Those teachers knew, like, this is the stuff that they we hope they learn. They might not learn. And it's, you know, the reason I started putting that on that level one, I kind of tossed and turned about that for a little bit, because I was like, is that, you know, lowering expectations, dropping the bar? And what I really landed on is, A, if I make the assumption that students are going to know it, like, that's the worst thing I can do as a teacher, is assume that a student's going to know something coming to me. But B, like, maybe it's below the grade level standard that I'm doing right now, but I want that entry point to be there. Because if there is no entry point for that student, then they're going to sit there and go, like we talked about, being in the trailhead, waiting for the hike, like, where I don't know where to go. I'm stuck. I'm trapped. And I don't want any student to feel that way. I want every student to see that path to success, even if it's just the first step on that path. I want them to be able to see that.
Okay. So transitioning now, so a kid is, say, beginning, is it developing as your second level? Beginning?
Yes.
Okay. Or phase one or phase two or whatever we want to talk about there. You also talk about in your book that, you know, feedback is really, really important. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you use the number three, I call it like your secret sauce, right?
Yep.
That's the secret sauce to feedback. But it's not really about the number of comments or questions you ask. It's about the quality of that feedback. Mm-hmm. Do you want to touch on that a little bit about feedback?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of my work with feedback was, and I'm sure I know you've had similar experiences as probably every English teacher has had, where like you spend your whole weekend leaving a bunch of feedback and comments and you're like, all right, this is.
And through that process, I learn a lot.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then you bring it all back and you're like, all right, kids are going to love it. They're going to use it. And then shockingly, I do it time and time again with the same expectations. It just wasn't going how I thought it would. And so kind of what you mentioned the number three, what I really had to think about is like, how much am I asking students to do at the same time? Like for me, I'm just writing 20 comments. I don't really think about it, but when I think about it from the student's perspective, that's 20 things I'm asking the student to learn at the same time. Our brain can't, like, it's not, you know, like, it's just not going to happen. So as much as I can be like, oh, kids aren't using feedback, it's really like kids can't use that much feedback. It's just not going to work. And so the number three in some of the research I did, they said, if you're giving feedback on an entire essay, the optimal number of comments to leave or things to ask students to engage in is three. And I will say, I actually very rarely would put three. It's usually two, maybe it's one. Because I just found, you know, if it's overwhelming for a student, if they see all of this feedback, as much as we want to frame it as advisement to help them move forward, they're seeing it as, these are things that I didn't do well. These are things that I did wrong. And if they're seeing 20 of those, all of a sudden it's like, well, mm-hmm. I probably should give up, because that cost is way too high for me to engage in all of that. So I mean, the best advice I always have for anyone who's like, feedback's not working, it sounds counterintuitive, but my response is give less.
Yes.
Give less feedback if you want students to engage in it.
Mm-hmm. And what about the quality of the individual feedback that you give? Are you more inclined to present a question or like something for them to think, as opposed to two pieces of feedback that, you know, are like, this is where your commas need to go, here, here, and here. So then they just go, okay, here, here, and here, right? They just mimic what, because we spoon feed it, right? We all do that. That's the that we've all done it. I'm part of the card carrying feedbacker that way, which I know is not a word as an English teacher, but whatever, right? But it's about the quality. It's about what you put on there, so we actually get them to think, correct?
Yeah. And so I ended up, so with technology, I found that was a huge piece that helped me with my feedback. I use text expanders. So it's, I actually got it from some of my friends they work in software engineering and stuff and coding. And I was saying one day, I was hanging out with some friends and I was like, I'm so tired of writing the same comments over and over. And like, instantly they were like, oh, you don't use a text expander? And they just said it as if I was the stupidest person in the world. And I was like, okay, you're gonna have to explain to me what that is. And they were like, well, you just set it up so there's a shortcut you can type, and then it'll populate this whole like however much text you want. And I was
Oh,
like,
that's sweet.
can you put
That's sweet.
links in there? And they were like, yeah. And so now the way that I like to leave feedback, I have those set up so that if, you know, if I know, hey, this is something we're working on, complete sentences, I know comma splices are something students are going to struggle with, I can create a comment in there that'll say, and I really try to identify trends. It's not about marking every mistake. It's looking at this. This is the trend I'm seeing, what we need to focus on next. And so it might say, I noticed as I was reading that comma splices are something that you should focus on learning next. I can give a whole description of what a comma splice is and resources linked in there. So that the student, because I think one of the tricky parts with feedback is the faster we can close the gap between getting the feedback and new learning. I think when students have to exist in that space for too long is where they start feeling like, you know, I got this feedback that I don't know how to do this thing. And then if I don't get a chance to learn how to do this thing, I'm sitting in this spot of limbo of going like, am I ever going to learn it? Like, can I do this? And I want to be able to give a resource right away of like, jump into this. This is your first step in learning it. Let's close that gap as much as we can. But the key with that is, and this is something that I was not doing initially, and I realized what I that was part of the problem, is making sure that if I'm leaving feedback, I'm planning time in my day with my students for them to do something with that feedback. That was the piece that I missed. I was just like, hey, here's a paper with a bunch of feedback. I expect you to use it next time. And then, you know, if it's on Google Classroom, like it's in their drive and they forgot it even existed the next time they go into
Or
another
if you
assignment.
want to, I'm available at
Yeah.
these times and you can't. Well, as soon as you tell kids if you want to, well, I don't want to. I'd rather go to McDonald's with
Yeah.
my friends at
Like I didn't want
lunchtime.
to initially, so I
Right,
still don't
right.
want.
Yeah. You almost have to put them in a situation where they have no choice.
Yeah. Yeah,
And
like
but they don't realize it because everybody else has feedback, right? It doesn't matter where they're at on the progression. Everybody's got some kind of feedback, so they all have something to work towards. Whether
And
they're at the top,
using,
the middle, or the beginning.
yeah, and using that progression as opposed to just a rubric, not only do I have something to work towards, I have something to work towards that's close. Like it's really creating the perception for students that if I use this feedback, I can be successful at my goal. And so the closer we can put that goal, the more realistic it is for the student to believe, like, okay, I got this feedback that says I need to work on comma splices. The next step in the progression is being able to identify an independent clause. Like, and if that feedback is really closely connected to that goal, then it's going to be a lot more likely that the student's going to engage in that feedback.
And you're not withholding the levels because they can see that when they actually attain that goal, they are going to get to the level. Because I know there's also a lot of conversations about, if we give feedback and the level, they won't do it. There's more nuance to it than that. And I will convince, I'm sure if someone did a Google search of a former comment I made probably about 3 or 4 years ago, I was probably one of the people who said, you have to leave the grade out. And I think it's a different conversation. I think what I've learned is there's more nuance to it. You're giving time, you're making the goal achievable, you're providing them feedback. Yeah, if I gave them a level and I gave them, and a feedback and then gave them no time, no further opportunities, then of course they're not going to improve. But there is more nuance to it, right? Yeah,
Yeah,
for
that's the thing
sure.
I feel like I'm just learning over and over again is how much nuance there is. And you know, I was always in the camp of like extrinsic motivation is bad. And then the more I learned about extrinsic motivation, I'm like, not all is bad. Not every single moment we use it is bad.
That's
There's certain,
right.
you know, like,
Yeah.
so yeah,
Have
this
you
is the
read
part.
Heather Lyon's book? Have you read that Engagement is Not a Unicorn, It's a Narwhal?
Not yet, but now I need to.
Oh, you put that in your Amazon cart, man. That, and I had her on the podcast. She was, I think, my fourth or fifth interview. And it's that exact thing. And I used to do the same thing, Tyler. I was like, there's a time and a place. And she has this beautiful like a four square grid, which actually talks about, what we have to do in the classroom and how the kid is engaged. And I'll let you go back and Give that a listen and get that book. But it's absolutely fabulous. I also love in your book, you ask this question, and I'm going to make a poster and I'm going to put it in my grade book. I'm going to put it behind my desks, my various desks, that you sometimes write on a kid's piece, what are you working on that I can help you with? Oh, I love that.
And
I
it
love that. Instead of feeling like I need to have all the answers, I'm going to open up this little communication door and kids can come to me and feel like, okay, I can go me and hopefully approach them. What do you get from that? How is it? What are the kids' responses to that?
and honestly, their responses tell me how well I'm doing with using the learning progressions. Because if I'm not revisiting them regularly, or if kids aren't really reflecting about them often, I get random comments, right? Like I'll get the, is it good? And I'm like, all right.
I know. Is this good? I
I'm
get that. I get that
like,
all the. Is this good?
that's not the most focused question I could be asked there. But, let's say we're working on a learning progression about complete sentences. If I have a student in there who says, I know comma splices are something I've been struggling with, how did I do with this? And so, not every student's going to be that specific and detailed, but for me, that's kind of my self-assessment as an educator, looking at how am I doing focusing students on the learning? How, you know, because that's where you're going to see questions related to the learning we're doing, as opposed to questions about how can I get the best grade? Like, is this good enough? Or all of those questions aren't really asking, help me with my learning. They're asking, help me get a good grade. And that's not the conversation that I want to be having with students.
Yeah. I want to move on to giving the final grade because, we're still in a system where. Like for us in BC, now it's only grade 10, 11, and 12 that we actually give a percentage.
Oh,
K to
interesting.
9, we're using the proficiency scale. Ultimately, we still have to go through a similar process, right? Like, because even if we have assessed a variety of standards, then we have to try to determine what's the overall proficiency scale indicator. Now you talk about in your book, you don't assess, first of all, you don't create progressions for every single standard. You choose the power standards, right? Very, very similar to what Dylan Williams says. You have, but you choose, like when you look at your curriculum, about 80% of the curriculum is what you make sure what you think kids need to know for sure. And the other 20 is, maybe I'll get to it, but it's, it just depends on how the year goes, right? So you've got your assessments now of all your power standards. What do you weight those power standards equally? And what do you do then to determine that percentage? And I'm going to add in a third piece there. Sorry to do this to you, Tyler. Actually, no, I'm going to let you go ahead with that, and then I'm going to come back to something else.
I do the way that I weight them, I weight each standard equally in my grade book. I haven't found, well, part of it, I don't love any online grade book that I've ever worked with. I actually do most of my record keeping with students in a spreadsheet. And I use that to communicate with them about learning. For me, the online grade book is like, what do administrators and parents need to see? Like, we're going to
Right.
do in our classroom what we need to do. And I'm going to make sure that I, communicate with the other stakeholders the stuff that's in there. So the way that I approach it is, let's say a student has had 5 or 6 attempts at a specific standard. At the end of that, we're going to sit down and look at your evidence along the way. I'm looking for recent, consistent, and convincing evidence. Like those are the three things that I'm really focused on with
Yeah.
students. And so we're looking at their more recent scores. What have you demonstrated multiple times that you're at? This is where I love switching to a more standards-based approach is, maybe there's a time where a student's at like they've had a 3, 4, 5 are their last three scores. And I'm like, hey, let's give you one more shot. I want you,
Yes.
if you can demonstrate to me again that you know this at the highest possible level, then
That's
you're
it.
there. You got
Yeah.
it. So the big thing for me that I always avoid when I think about calculating the final grade is I am not averaging scores over time. Like I feel like I need that on a t-shirt that I
Me
just wear
too.
around.
Me too.
Because I think, and it's so important to me that we don't do that, because when we do that, your student that starts the lowest will end the lowest. It's just sort of the reality of how it's most likely going to work out if we average their first attempt with, you know, the rest of their attempts along the way. You might have kids that end at the exact same level of understanding, but the student that came in with knowledge gaps worked their butt off to get all the way, you know, grow as much as they can. They're going to be penalized for the where they started. And, you know, that, again, that hidden communication that we have within our grading and assessment practices, it kind of communicates to students where you start will dictate how far you can go. Right. And like, when you think about that in a broader context, it's the exact opposite reason that I got into education. And so I don't average scores over time. That is the big thing that I really had to change in how I was assessing students initially. And so instead of averaging scores over time, the only way that I've found to make what I want to do with assessment match with what our system needs is then are sort of the current scores for each of the standards. It's
right.
It's those pieces that will make up what their final grade is.
Okay. Yeah. Do you use like a logic rule or anything like that? Like, what have you found?
I don't. I played with the power law. I've played with decaying averages.
So much,
like,
right? I think as long as you're consistent and as long as you're not averaging scores, I think you got to, you do you.
Yeah. Like I
the
have
kids, go ahead.
I have a few rules that I have in place. Like it has to be repeated multiple times. I have to have at least half the evidence of learning to be able to determine a grade, like things that I have to keep consistent for just equity across everything. But I feel like every time I've tried to use like the power law or decaying averages or any of those, a student's going to come along that throws a wrench in that entire process because they just don't fit inside that box or something they didn't work with that rule. And so I've found it's a lot of it comes down to professional judgment. A lot of it comes down to looking at the evidence we have in front of me. And a lot of it comes down to the conversation with that student. A lot of times, one of my favorite questions to ask is like, here's the evidence we have so far. What is this not showing? And then the student is able to have a little bit of power involved there to say, look, I struggled with on the test with this, but I know it now. Like I know this. They can give me more evidence and we can then use that.
Yeah. And I think it's sad when I have to have conversations with students and, you know, explain that this is what I'm doing. Like, I'm going to count your most recent evidence of learning. And they look at me like, what? Like, you're doing what? And they almost can't believe it. That's why they're asking for the grade. They're so used to points being put into a grade book. And then again, vending machine, right? It's puking up this percentage. They want to know where they're at. And is this going to drop me? Is this going to increase me? When, you know, we're giving them the benefit of the doubt. And we are also fostering an environment that gives them a chance to risk take, right? Mm-hmm. They know that if they screw up, they're going to get feedback and they're going to get time to improve. And when they improve, that's what's going to matter.
And
that's what's going to matter.
But you're
right
that they don't believe you. Like that's one of the things I have to do early on is actually let them struggle on something and then not hold that against them. Because they think, even if I say, hey, if you struggle on your first couple attempts, it won't matter at the end. They're just sitting there waiting for you to like pull the cover back, tell them you were lying all along and their grade's terrible. And it's, you know, they're just so used to this idea that every single thing I do in the classroom can be used against me. I don't, that's not the best wording for it, but I think that's how they feel sometimes.
Though. Oh, I you've probably seen me post the beginning of the course. And this is really powerful with my English First Peoples 10 classes. These grade 10s, you know, they're on the grad path, I'll call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, you know, what does school expect from you? What do you expect from school? And a lot of the times I get, you know, school doesn't trust me. They don't believe, they don't give me that other opportunity. They don't realize that we have all this other stuff going on, you know? And I think going shifting to standards-based grading, it's the equity piece, right? It's if I have set up my course in such a way that I'm going to be constantly lapping the standards, if a kid was sick for 3 weeks with COVID, they can walk in and they've got their entry point. And or, you know, if what's the skill we're working on? We're working on essay writing. I'm not going to make you read the book now. You missed the book. I'm going to give you an 8-page short story so you can write the essay alongside your peers and learn the skill. And I get pushback sometimes from educators on that. Like, but don't they have to read the book? There will be other books. You know, what is the skill we're working on here, folks? Right. And you know what? I will have that exact same approach if that was a kid who had been suspended 3 times and they walked in, they came in 3 weeks late, or a kid who transferred schools. It's not about excusing kids. We're not excusing kids from the learning, but we're giving them other opportunities. But you also said, you know, you have conversations with your students about the assessment piece. And it's not that we're trying to throw our colleagues under the bus. It's that it's important to have these conversations with them so they understand what's going on. Like, this is our approach and this is how it's going to happen. And keep coming back to it so that they get it.
Yeah. And you know, I will admit early on, I was very much like, oh, the other way is bad. And, you know, this is right. And then I was like, oh, let's hope that doesn't get to the other teachers. This is not. And, you know, it's not necessarily, it's not a matter of right and wrong. It's a matter of know better, do better. And so, like, for me, I am always hesitant to say, like, you know, this is the wrong thing. This is why we don't do it in the class. But, like, you know, you're talking about assessing students, and if they miss a bunch, like letting them start with the class, we'll get to that standard again. You know, for me, it's not a matter of trying to say, we're going to excuse you because this is the right thing to do. It's what I know about your brain and how brains work is if I try to have you read the entire book and write an essay, I'm setting you up for failure. Like you're not going to be able to learn this. And so as much as we want to, I guess the question you said, like, hold them accountable. The question always is, what are we holding them accountable to? Is it to doing stuff or learning things? Because sometimes, not always, but sometimes those two go head to head. And when it comes down to it, when I'm stuck in that position, my answer is always learning things. Now, do I want them to learn to be, you know, to be responsible, stay on top of things? Absolutely. Like, that is something that's why I loved having the conversational piece of my assessment practices with students is, you know, I used to like slap a late penalty on something. And I don't know if I ever saw that really change behavior long-term. They might've scrambled the next time and turned in some half done paper so they didn't get the late penalty. But the more, what I found work better is if that student turns in a number of assignments late or they're missing, and then we sit down and have a conversation, and I'm able to say, like, hey, this is what I'm seeing. This is a big concern for me. Those conversations, knowing that I'm holding them accountable, right? Like, we are still going to have that conversation, and it is a much more personal form of accountability. I'm going to hold them accountable, but I also want them to know I care enough that I'm going to sit down with them and we need to figure this out. Mm-hmm. I found that approach to be much more effective than sort of the depersonalized grade piece that half the time they don't even realize why their grade went down.
Yeah, no. And I think even for educators out there listening who are, they're not standards based yet and they haven't set up their year. If a kid comes in, they miss the first unit, you know, especially like I can think of it as like a drama teacher and an English teacher, you know, think about what was your goal in unit one? Right? As an English teacher, let's say you still have the old style framework. You know, you've got your grade book set up with assignments and tests and projects, et cetera. Okay. Think about what was the goal in that first unit? What was it you're getting to do as a writing unit? Okay. Oh, okay. So you're working on your writing skills and now you feel like you're kind of in like a short story unit where you're just focusing on comprehension. Well, you know, you can now tailor maybe some assignments, you know, exclusive to the student who came in late for whatever reason and getting them to actually do the two in tandem, right? They can work on the comprehension and the writing and then show that evidence of learning, and then you can, kind of figure out your grade book. Like, that's essentially what we're doing. Like, so, if you are thinking, well, I can't do this because I don't have my semester set up the way, Tyler and Shannon have their grade, they have their semester set up. That's the kind of thinking, right? Think about what was the skill, what was the goal, and see how can I bring that goal, intertwine that goal. And you know what? You might, and then you're going to see that that is also maybe going to be good for some of the kids who were there, but maybe were unsuccessful in that first unit. And then you can support those kids in that way as well.
And I think you captured one of the biggest shifts when you use the phrase evidence of learning. Like, I even more important to me than changing the format of our grade book, if I can change my mindset from I'm grading assignments to I'm looking for evidence of learning, that's where you start seeing, even no matter what your grading system looks like, you start seeing those open doors to support students in different ways.
That phrase, now I just feel like it's ingrained. Learning opportunity is another one. And like you and I have both touched on it, professional judgment. It's, we talk about electronic grade books. I was able to finesse my grade book where I literally just use shortcut keys to assess learning. So then the kids can see where they're at now for each of, we use curricular competency standards, and there's no points. I don't have to worry about anything tabulating anything. And they can just, see where they're at those competencies. And then the only time I actually deal with the number is when I sit back, I use my logic rule, and I figure out that's where they're at. So I get that. Oh, well, assessment, it's just one of those things we could talk about for hours. And I've so enjoyed it. But I want to ask you if you're ready for your elevator pitch question.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you're ready. Okay. Elevator pitch is something I do with all of my guests. So, Tyler, you are on an elevator and you're at the third floor, and an educator gets on the elevator and presses six. This educator tells you they want to disassemble their traditional assessment practices because they feel it isn't doing right by students anymore. You only have three floors. And I get that you're not going to change the world in three floors, but what would you suggest is the first shift they make?
My answer is always imagine what it would look like if you couldn't average scores over time. That thought experiment alone changes how we have to look at grading and assessment. And so when we think about, right now, it's the way we do it. We put a bunch of assignments in, spits out a score at the end. That's the average over time. If that was completely taken away and we didn't have that as an option, what does that look like? And the reason I like framing it as a question for people is because I think sometimes when we say you should switch to standards-based grading, there's so many misconceptions about it, so much confusion around it, that instantly it's this big thing. Yeah, it blows up. We try to push it away. But if it's framed as a question, you can't average scores over time. What do you do? Most of the time I've had this conversation with people, we start getting to really thinking about, okay, well, I would have to be looking for the skills. I'm like, all right, we're moving,
Yeah,
and
now we're getting there.
it naturally lends itself to looking more at, okay, I need something that will give me evidence of this thing that I'm trying to get students to learn. And once we're there, I mean, we're off and running. Like, once we get to that spot and we've conceptualized this idea of there's a different and maybe better way to do it, once we've crossed through that door, we're out and able to do great things for kids.
I love that answer. I mean, I have to admit, you're at the penthouse now, Tyler, but that's
Yeah, I was gonna just stop after you can't average grades and then just that was it,
what?
but
I often tell guests, it's okay. There was a little technical problem on the elevator that gave you a little bit more time. No, I love it because again, I found even like since starting podcasting, any nuggets of wisdom from any of my guests, it just feels like free pro D. And I got to tell you, listeners, run, don't walk to your nearest bookstore or to your computer. I'm going to get the title right here, Hacking Student Motivation. You can get it Kindle. You can get hard copy, right? Or is it soft cover, right? Or whatever.
There's both. I haven't seen the hard copy, but I know it exists. So there's a soft cover and a hard cover.
All right. And you just got your hands on your own officially just this week, didn't you?
I
Right?
did. That was a really fun experience for me.
Tyler, congratulations. When I saw online, I think years ago when you said that you were going to be writing this book, I thought, I can't think of, I mean, there are a lot of folks out there, with that passion to share their learning, and it's such a vulnerable experience. And maybe someday I'll get there too, right? And it's, but I'm just so grateful for anyone who's willing to, peel off some of the layers and share it. And it was amazing. Just, like I said, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, I got my copy, I started reading it, and I spent hours on my laptop. I could not stop because it was just speaking my truth. And I was like, this is awesome. And it's definitely going to be on my list. I run a Facebook group called Beyond Report Cards, and it's going to be on my list as a choice for Summer Book Club because
Oh,
it's amazing. Thank you
thank you
so much
so
for
much.
coming on today.
I had a great time. I love getting to talk to you. This is fun for the first time face to face. This has been great.
Well, hopefully the first of many, because I got a funny feeling this is not your first and only book, my friend.
I will take a break, but there are already wheels turning in my brain. I don't think I like that there are wheels turning, but there are wheels turning. So, yeah.
I'm honored to have produced this and all episodes of the Embrace the Messy podcast with Shannon Schinkel on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Tlele T'enneh First Nation. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and share it with a colleague or friend. Doing so will help others find the podcast. Know someone who embraces the messy and would make a great guest on the pod? Email me at embracethemessypodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.